The statues were better than the paintings. Differences in pigment and lighting did not intrude. Most did show motifs, but they were more than portraits. A chain of motifs of diminishing size. Porter to 3 whites, to 9 browns, to 27 miniatures? No, they were all done in white marble, and had the shape of decision-makers. Barry regarded them without expression and said, "It occurs to me that I will need interpretations of any of these before I could sell them anywhere, or even give them as gifts." "Inevitably so," said Barry's motif. "This, for instance, illustrates a religion of the last century. The soul of the parent divides to become the children, and again to become the grandchildren, ad infinitum." Another showed a number of motifs in red sandstone. They had long, slender fingers, too many on the left hand, and the left arm was comparatively small. Physicians? They were being killed by a thread of green glass that swept among them like a scythe, a laser weapon held by something offstage. The motifs were reluctant to talk about it. "An unpleasant event in history," said Barry's motif, and that was that. Another showed fighting among a few marble whites, and a score of an unrecognizable type done in red sandstone. The red ones were lean and menacing, armed with more than their share of teeth and claws. Some weird machine occupied the center of the melee. "Now that one is interesting," said Renner's motif. "By tradition, a mediator, one of our own type, may requisition any kind of transportation he needs from any decision-maker. Long ago, a mediator used his authority to order a time machine built. I can show you the machine, if you will travel to it. It is on the other side of this continent." "A working time machine?" "Not working, Jonathan. It was never completed. His master went broke trying to finish it."
"Oh,"
Whitbread showed his disappointment. "It was never tested," said the motif. "The basic theory may be flawed." The machine looked like a small cyclotron with a cabin inside. It almost made sense, like a Langston Field generator. "You interest me strangely," Renner said to his motif. "You can requisition any transportation, any time?" "That's right. Our talent is communication, but our major task is stopping fights. Sally has lectured us on your, let's say your racial problems involving weapons and the surrender reflex. We mediators evolved out of that. We can explain one being's viewpoint to another. Non-communication can assume dangerous proportions sometimes, usually just before a war, by one of those statistical flukes that make you believe in coincidence. If one of us can always get to transportation, or even to telephones or radios, war becomes unlikely." There were awed expressions among the humans. "Very nice," said Renner. Then, "I was wondering whether you could requisition MacArthur." "By law and tradition, yes. In practice, don't be a fool." "Okay. These things fighting around the time machine." "Legendary demons," Barry's motif explained. "They defend the structure of reality." Renner remembered ancient Spanish paintings dating from the time of the Black Plague in Europe, paintings of living men and women being attacked by the revived and malevolent dead. Next to the white motifs, these red sandstone things had that impossibly lean, bony look, and a malevolence that was almost tangible. "And why the time machine?" "The mediator felt that a certain incident in history had happened because of a lack of communication. He decided to correct it." Renner's motif shrugged. With her arms, a motif couldn't lift her shoulders. "Crazy Eddie. The Crazy Eddie probe was like that. A little more workable, maybe. A watcher of the sky, a meteorologist, plus some other fields, found evidence that there was life on a world of a nearby star. Right away, this Crazy Eddie mediator wanted to contact them. He tied up enormous amounts of capital and industrial power, enough to affect most of civilization. He got his probe built, powered by a light sail and a battery of laser cannon for—" "This all sounds familiar." "Right. The Crazy Eddie probe was in fact launched toward New Caledonia much later, and with a different pilot. We've been assuming you followed it home." "So it worked. Unfortunately, the crew was dead, but it reached us. So why are you still calling it the Crazy Eddie probe? No, never mind, said Renner. His moti was chortling. Two limousines were waiting for them outside the museum, and a stairs had been erected leading down to street level. Tiny two-seater cars zipped around the obstruction without slowing down and without collisions. Staley stopped at the bottom.
Mr. Renner, look!
Renner looked. A car had stopped alongside a great blank building, for there were no curbs. The brown chauffeur and his white-furred passenger disembarked, and the white walked briskly around the corner. The brown disengaged two hidden levers at the front, then heaved against the side of the car. It collapsed like an accordion, into something half a meter wide. The brown turned and followed the white moti.
"They fold up!" Staley exclaimed.
"Sure they do," said Renner's moti. "Can you imagine the traffic jam if they didn't? Come on, get in the cars."
They did.
Renner said, "I wouldn't ride in one of those little death traps for Barry's own petty cash fund."
"Oh, they're safe." "That is," said Renner's moti. "It isn't the car that's safe, it's the driver. Browns don't have much territorial instinct, for one thing. For another, they're always fiddling with the car, so nothing's ever going to fail."
The limousine started off. Browns appeared behind them and began removing the stairs. The buildings around them were always square blocks, the streets a rectangular grid. To Horvath, the city was clearly a made city, not something that had grown naturally. Someone had laid it out and ordered it built from scratch. Were they all like this? It showed none of the Browns' compulsion to innovate. And yet, he decided, it did. Not in basics, but in such things as street lighting. In places, they were broad, electroluminescent strips along the buildings. In others, they were things like floating balloons, but the wind did not move them. Elsewhere, tubes ran along the sides of the streets, or down the center, or there was nothing at all that showed in the daytime. And those box-like cars, each was subtly different in the design of the lights or the signs of repairs or the way the parked cars folded into themselves. The limousines stopped.
"We're here," Horvath's moti announced. "The zoo. The Life Forms Preserve, to be more exact. You'll find that it is arranged more for the convenience of the inhabitants than for the spectators."
Horvath and the rest looked about, puzzled. Tall, rectangular buildings surrounded them. There was no open space anywhere.
"On our left. The building, gentlemen. The building. Is there some law against putting a zoo inside a building?"
The zoo, as it developed, was 6 stories tall, with ceilings uncommonly high for motis. It was difficult to tell just how high the ceilings were. They looked like sky. On the first floor, it was open blue sky, with drifting clouds and a sun that stood just past noon. They strolled through a steamy jungle whose character changed as they moved. The animals could not reach them, but it was difficult to see why not. They did not seem aware of being penned up. There was a tree like a huge bullwhip, its handle planted deep in the earth, its lash sprouting clusters of round leaves where it coiled around the trunk. An animal like a giant moti stood flat-footed beneath it, staring at Whitbread. There were sharp, raking talons on its two right hands, and tusks showed between its lips. "It was a variant of the porter type," said Horvath's moti, "but never successfully domesticated. You can see why."
"These artificial environments are astounding," Horvath exclaimed. "I've never seen better. But why not build part of the zoo in the open? Why make an environment when the real environment is already there?"
"I'm not sure why it was done, but it seems to work out." The second floor was a desert of dry sand. The air was dry and balmy. The sky baby blue, darkening to yellow-brown at the horizon. Fleshy plants with no thorns grew through the sand. Some were the shape of thick lily pads. Many bore the marks of nibbling teeth. They found the beast that had made the tooth marks, a thing like a nude white beaver with square, protruding teeth. It watched them tamely as they passed. On the third floor, it was raining steadily.
Lightning flashed, illusory miles away. The humans declined to enter, for they had no rain gear. The Motis were half angry, half apologetic. It had not occurred to them that rain would bother humans. They liked it.
"It's going to keep happening, too," Whitbread's Moti predicted. "We study you, but we don't know you. You're missing some of the most interesting platforms, too. Perhaps another day, when they have the rain turned off."
The fourth floor was not wild at all. There were even small round houses on distant illusory hills. Small, umbrella-shaped trees grew red and lavender fruits beneath a flat green disk of foliage. A pair of proto-motis stood beneath one of these. They were small, round, and pudgy, and their right arms seemed to have shrunk. They looked at the tour group with sad eyes. Then one reached up for a lavender fruit. Its left arm was just long enough.
"Another unworkable member of our species," said Horvath Smoti. "Extinct now except in life forms preserves."
He seemed to want to hurry them on. They found another pair in a patch of melons, the same breed of melon the humans had eaten for dinner, as Hardy pointed out. In a wide, grassy field, a family of things with hooves and shaggy coats grazed placidly, except for one that stood guard, turning constantly to face the visitors. A voice behind Whitbread said, "You're disappointed. Why?" Whitbread looked back in surprise.
"Disappointed? No, it's fascinating."
"My mistake," said Whitbread's Moti. "I think I'd like a word with Mr. Renner. Care to trail along?" The party was somewhat spread out. Here there was no chance of getting lost, and they all enjoyed the feel of grass beneath their feet. Long, coiled green blades, springier than an ordinary lawn, much like the living carpets in houses of the aristocracy and the wealthier traders. Renner looked amiably about when he felt eyes on him.
"Yes?"
"Mr. Renner, it strikes me that you're a bit disappointed in our zoo." Whitbread winced. Renner frowned.
"Yeah, and I've been trying to figure it out. I shouldn't feel this way. It's a whole alien world, all compacted for our benefit.
Whitbread, you feel it too?"
Whitbread nodded reluctantly. "Ha! That's it. It's an alien world, all compacted for our benefit, right? How many zoos have you seen on how many worlds?"
Whitbread counted in his head.
6, including Earth.
"And they were all like this one, except that the illusion is better. We were expecting something a whole order of magnitude different. It isn't. It's just another alien world, except for the intelligent Motis."
"Makes sense," said Whitbread's Moti.
Perhaps her voice was a little wistful, and the humans remembered that the Motis had never seen an alien world. "Too bad, though," the Motis said. "Staley's having a ball. So are Sally and Dr. Hardy, but they're professionals." But the next floor was a shock. Dr. Horvath was first out of the elevator. He stopped dead. He was in a city street.
"I think we have the wrong door."
He trailed off. For a moment, he felt that his mind was going. The city was deserted. There were a few cars in the streets, but they were wrecks, and some showed signs of fire. Several buildings had collapsed, filling the street with mountains of rubble. A moving mass of black chittered at him and moved away in a swarm, away and into dark holes in a slope of broken masonry, until there were none left. Horvath's skin crawled. When an alien hand touched his elbow, he jumped and gasped. "What's the matter, Doctor? Surely you have animals evolved for cities?"
"No," said Horvath.
"Rats," said Sally Fowler, "and there's a breed of lice that lives only on human beings, but I think that's all."
"We have a good many," said Horvath Smoti. "Perhaps we can show you a few, though they're shy."
At a distance, the small black beasts were indistinguishable from rats. Hardy snapped a picture of a swarm that was scrambling for cover. He hoped to develop a blow-up later. There was a large, flattish beast, almost invisible, until they were right in front of it. It was the color and pattern of the brick it was clinging to.
"Like a chameleon," Sally said.
Then she had to explain chameleons.
"There's another," Sally's Moti said.
She pointed out a concrete-colored animal clinging to a gray wall.
Don't try to disturb it. It has teeth.
Where do they get their food?
Roof gardens, though they can eat meat.
And there's an insectivore. She led them to a rooftop 2 meters above street level. There were grain and fruit trees gone riot, and a small armless biped that fired a coiled tongue over a meter long. It looked as if it had a mouthful of walnuts. Bitter cold met them on the 6th floor. The sky was leaden gray. Snow blew in flurries across an infinity of icy tundra. Hardy wanted to stay, for there was considerable life in that cold hell. Bushes and tiny trees growing through the ice. A large, placid thing that ignored them. A furry, hopping snowshoe rabbit with dish-shaped ears and no front legs. They almost had to use force to get Hardy out, but he would have frozen in there. Dinner was waiting for them at the castle. Ship's stores and slices of a flat, green, moti cactus, 75 centimeters across and 3 thick. The red jelly inside tasted almost meaty. Renner liked it, but the others couldn't eat it at all. The rest they ate like starved men, talking animatedly between mouthfuls. It must have been the extra-long day that made them so hungry. Renner's moti said, "We have some idea what a tourist wants to see in a strange city. At least we know what you show in your travel films. Museums, the place of government, monuments, unique architecture, perhaps the shops and nightclubs. Above all, the way of life of the native." She gestured deprecatingly. "We've had to omit some of this. We don't have any nightclubs. Too little alcohol doesn't do anything to us. Too much kills. You'll get a chance to hear our music, but frankly, you won't like it. Government is mediators meeting to talk. It might be anywhere. The decision-makers live where they like, and they generally consider themselves bound by the agreements of their mediators. You'll see some of our monuments. As for our way of life, you've been studying that for some time." "What about the way of life of a white?" Hardy asked. Then his mouth opened in a bone-cracking yawn. "He's right," Hardy's moti broke in. "We should be able to see a giver of orders' family residence at work. It may be that we can get permission." The alien broke into a high gabble. The motis considered. Sally's moti said, "It should be possible. We'll see. In the meantime, let's call it a day." For the time change had caught the humans. Doctors Horvath and Hardy yawned, blinked, looked surprised, made their excuses, and departed. Barry was still going strong. Renner wondered what rotation his planet had. He himself had had enough space-going training to adapt to any schedule. But the party was breaking up. Sally said her goodnights and went upstairs, swaying noticeably. Renner suggested folk singing, got no response, and quit. A spiral stair ran up the tower. Renner turned off into a corridor, following his curiosity. When he reached an airlock, he realized that it must lead to the balcony, the flat ring that circled the tower. He did not care to try the Mote Prime air. He wondered if the balcony was meant to be used at all, and then thought of a ring encircling a slender tower, and wondered if the motis were playing games with Freudian symbolism. Probably they were. He continued to his room. Renner thought at first he was in the wrong room. The color scheme was striking, orange and black, quite different from the muted pale browns of this morning. But the pressure suit on the wall was his design and rank markings on the chest. He looked about him, trying to decide whether he liked the change. It was the only change. No, the room was warmer. It had been too cold last night. On a hunch, he crossed the room and checked the Moti's sleeping alcove. Yes, it was chilly in there. Renner's moti leaned against the door jamb, watching him with the usual slight smile. Renner grinned shamefacedly. Then he continued his inspection. The bathroom. The toilet was different, just as he had sketched it. Wrong, there wasn't any water in it, and no flush. What the hell? There was only one way to test a toilet. When he looked, the bowl was sparkling clean. He poured a glass of water into it and watched it run away without leaving a drop. The bowl was a frictionless surface. Have to mention this to Barry, he thought. There were bases on airless moons and worlds where water, or energy for recycling it, was scarce. Tomorrow. He was too sleepy now. The rotation period of Levant was 28 hours 40.2 minutes. Barry had adjusted well enough to MacArthur's standard day, but it is always easier to adjust to a longer day than to a shorter. He waited while his fianche sent their brown for coffee. It made him miss Nabil, and wonder if the brown had more of Nabil's skills. He had already seriously underestimated the power of the brown and whites. Apparently his Moti could commandeer any vehicle on Mot Prime, whether or not it had been built yet. Even so, he was an agent for someone Barry had never seen. The situation was complex. The brown returned with coffee and another pot, something that poured pale brown and did not steam. Poisonous? Very likely, his fianche said. The pollutants might harm you, or the bacteria. It's water from outside. It was not Barry's habit to come too quickly to business. An overeager businessman, he felt, was easily gulled. He was not aware of the thousands of years of tradition behind his opinion. Accordingly, he and his Moti liaison talked of many things. Of shoes and ships and sealing wax, of cabbages and kings, he quoted, and he identified all of these to his Moti's evident interest. The Moti was particularly interested in the various forms of human government. "But I don't think I should read this Lewis Carroll," he said, "until I know considerably more of human culture." Eventually, Barry raised the subject of luxuries again. "Luxuries. Yes, I agree in principle," said Barry's Moti. "If a luxury travels well, it can pay for itself merely in diminished fuel costs. That must be true, even with your crazy eddy drive. But in practice, there are restrictions between us." Barry had already thought of a few. He said, "Tell me of them." "Coffee, teas, wines. I presume you deal in wines also?" "Wine is forbidden to my religion." Barry dealt indirectly in the transfer of wines from world to world, but he could not believe the Motis would want to deal in wines. "It doesn't matter. We could not tolerate alcohol, and we do not like the taste of coffee. The same would probably apply to your other luxury foods, though they may be worth a try." "And you do not yourselves deal in luxuries?" "No. In power over others, in safety, in durability of customs and dynasties. As usual, I speak for the givers of orders. We deal in these, for their benefit, but we also deal in diplomacy. We trade durable goods and necessities, skills. What do you think of our works of art?"
"They would sell at good prices until they became common. But I think our trade will be more in ideas and designs."
"Ah? The frictionless toilet and the principle behind it. Various superconductors, which you fabricate more efficiently than we. We found a sample in an asteroid. Can you duplicate it?"
"I'm sure the Browns will find a way." The Moti waved a languid hand. "There will be no problem here. You certainly have much to offer. Land, for instance. We will want to buy land for our embassies."
Probably that would be offered gratis, Barry thought.
But to this race, land would be literally priceless. Without the humans, they could never have more than they had at the moment. And they would want land for settlements. This world was crowded. Barry had seen the city lights from orbit, a field of light around dark oceans.
"Land," he agreed. "And grain. There are grains that grow beneath suns like yours. We know that you can eat some of them. Might they grow here more efficiently than yours? Bulk food would never be shipped at a profit, but seeds, maybe. You may also have ideas to sell us."
"I wonder.
Your inventiveness is enormous and admirable." The Moti waved a hand. "I thank you, but we have not made everything there is to make. We have our own crazy eddy drive, for example, but the force field generator that protects... If I should be shot, you would lose the only merchant in this system."
"Allahs! I mean to say, are your authorities really so determined to guard their secrets?
Perhaps they will change their minds when they know you better. Besides, I'm not a physicist, Barry said blandly.
Ah, Barry, we have not exhausted the subject of art. Our artists have a free hand and ready access to materials, and very little supervision. In principle, the exchange of art between Moat and Empire would facilitate communication. We have never yet tried to aim our art at an alien mind.
Dr. Hardy's books and education tapes contain many such works of art. We must study them.
Barry's Moti sipped contemplatively at his dirty water.
We spoke of coffees and wines. My associates have noticed, how shall I put it, a strong cultural set toward wines among your scientists and Navy officers.
Yes, place of origin, dates, labels, ability to travel in freefall, what wines go with what foods.
Barry grimaced.
I have listened, but I know nothing of this. I find it annoying and expensive that some of my ships must move under constant acceleration merely to protect a wine bottle from its own sediments. Why can they not simply be centrifuged on arrival?
And coffees? They all drink coffee.
Coffee varies according to its genetics, soil, climate, method of roasting.
I know this is so. I have seen your stores.
I have much greater variety aboard MacArthur.
Yes, and there is variety among coffee drinkers. Cultural differences. On an American-descended world like Tabletop, they would not touch the oily brew preferred in New Paris, and they find the brew of Levant much too sweet and strong.
Ah.
Have you heard of Jamaica Blue Mountain? It grows on Earth itself, on a large island. The island was never bombed, and the mutations were weeded out in the centuries following the collapse of the Co-Dominium. It cannot be bought. Navy ships carry it to the Imperial Palace on Sparta.
How does it taste?
As I told you, it is reserved for the royal...
Barry hesitated.
Very well. You know me that well. I would not pay such a price again, but I do not regret it.
The Navy misjudges your worth because you lack knowledge of wines.
Barry's Moti did not seem to be smiling. Its bland expression was a trader's. It matched Barry's own.
Quite foolish of them, of course. If they knew how much there was to learn about coffee...
What are you suggesting?
You have stores aboard. Teach them about coffee. Use your own stores for the purpose.
My stores would not last a week among the officers of a battle cruiser.
You would show them a similarity between your culture and theirs. Or do you dislike that idea?
No, Barry, I am not reading your mind. You dislike the Navy. You tend to exaggerate the differences between them and you. Perhaps they think the same way.
I am not reading your mind.
Barry suppressed the fury building in him, and at that moment he saw it. He knew why the alien kept repeating that phrase. It was to keep him off balance in a trading situation.
Barry smiled broadly.
A week's worth of goodwill. Well, I will try your suggestion when we are back in orbit, and I dine aboard MacArthur. Allah knows they have much to learn about coffee. Perhaps I can even teach them how to use their percolators correctly.
28. Coffee Clutch.
Rod and Sally sat alone in the captain's patrol cabin. The intercom screens were off, and the status board above Rod's desk showed a neat pattern of green lights. Rod stretched his long legs out and sipped at his drink.
You know, this is about the first time we've had alone together since we left New Caledonia. It's nice.
She smiled uncertainly.
But we don't have very long. The Motis are expecting us to come back, and I've got dictating to do. How much longer can we stay in the Moat system, Rod?
Blaine shrugged. Up to the Admiral. Viceroy Merrill wanted us back as soon as possible, but Dr. Horvath wants to learn more.
So do I.
Sally, we still don't have anything significant to report. We don't know whether the Motis are a threat to the Empire or not.
Rod Blaine, will you stop acting like a regular Navy officer and be yourself? There is not one shred of evidence that the Motis are hostile. We haven't seen any signs of weapons or wars or anything like that.
I know, Rod said sourly, and that worries me.